All right, a few announcements before we begin. Since we did not, or voted not to move, we're going to have a setup schedule again for next year. So if somebody wants to oversee that, get it all filled out, see Bill. This is also the time of year to figure out, you know, kind of what months you might think you want to apply. Also, just a reminder, a month from now, I did decide on, I think I told everybody, the 28th and 29th of December, there will not be Bible class. That's a Tuesday and a Wednesday also. I have decided to go ahead and have class on Sunday. So, but that's the day after Christmas, so everybody's usually pretty well done by then. On another front, got a email from a lady in Colorado who says they're interested. They're planning on moving to Florida and buying and wanted to. They're apparently in a doctrinal church of some sort. I don't know exactly. It's a Bible church at any rate. She was familiar with Bob Theme, so she's heard some doctrine, I know. They're just in the preliminary stages, but she, you know, contacted us and asked me to give her a call, so I did. Chatted with her about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 minutes, just told her what we do and that we've been at it. And she said, well, do you plan on staying there? I said, I'm planning on it. I said, we've been here 32 years, so I don't think we're going anywhere. At least that's not the goal. Then I got an email yesterday from a girl who said she was going to attend. Don't think she made it. But at any rate, so I guess the website, people are still finding us out there. So certainly pray about that it does effectively what it does. We want positive believers, again, who are serious about the scriptures and want to grow up and do all the things that are incumbent upon us and live in God's directive will, frankly. At any rate, continue to pray about that. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship here and let's get back to it. Philippians chapter 1, verse 9, and this I pray. I pray that your love may abound still more and more. Indicating, of course, that the love was already present. They were applying towards one another, but that it could improve. And the love is to be tempered by these qualities associated with real knowledge. Again, and discrimination, discernment. The ability to see things clearly rather than just sometimes there was no real discernment even among when I first got started down here. And of course, all these people thought they were mature and fine and had it all together, which they did not. One guy, when I first got on my first board, his answer to everything was throw money at it. Whatever the problem was, throw money at it. And that's not discerning. That doesn't address problems even. Now, there may be problems. I'm not arguing that there aren't times and places where money is the answer. But that's not it every time. Certainly not every time. So we were down through this in real knowledge and all discernment. I think we left off with point 33. Thus, this term deals with the ability, this eisthesis, to make proper moral and doctrinal decisions, in spite of the fact that there might be a vast assortment of differing and or difficult choices presented to the believer. It's to make the right doctrinal choice. Where does God want me first? When am I supposed to be there? Everything from where you are to how you do it. All of that. So the fact that this anarthrous noun is modified by the adjective pos. Anarthrous, of course, means no definite article. Indicates that the idea of every kind of discernment. Rather than all discernment. It deals with the depth or the scope of one's perception and discernment. And so clearly one of the things is that Paul desires that believers see things clearly and understand things clearly. And then have the discrimination and the ability to make decisions when they're confronted with them. As we all have to. Well, while Paul prays for their love to continue to grow, it is evident that biblical love is to be regulated by knowledge and a clear perception that provides the ability to be properly discriminating in the exercise of one's love. These are not to be excuses for why we don't have to love. These are to be adjuncts to that love that make the love stronger and more refined in that sense. Again, the use of these two qualifying terms certainly stress the need for wisdom and discernment if one is to do the right thing and act properly in every circumstance. Apart from knowledge and insight, one will not likely express love in a way that is appropriate to each situation he encounters. And if you look back in the book of Proverbs, really right there in the first chapter, we see that this is the basis, this is the reason for getting wisdom. The studying the writings, the inspired writings of Scripture. And in this case, the inspired writings are the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. And you'd be surprised at how many liberal interpreters say, nope, this isn't Solomon, even though it clearly says it is. They don't like it. So what are the purpose of these Proverbs? To know wisdom and instruction. To be discerning with regard to the sayings of understanding. To receive instruction in wise behavior. Righteousness, justice, and equity. To give prudence to the naive. There are two kinds of naive people. There are people that are naive because they lack experience because they're young. And that sort of naivete is okay for a while. I mean, it's at least acceptable. It's a part of growing. You're not born into this world knowing everything. You have to, in some cases, experience bad things to see that there's a bad world out there. To not be taken in by things. I'm astonished still that there's so much fraud that's perpetrated upon people over their telephone. That they don't seem to have the discernment to recognize that you don't recognize this caller. Why even answer it? And if it's important, they'll call back. I've gotten to where when I know it's a scam call, I mean, they may be selling anything from auto warranty services. Everybody's probably heard that one about 10 times. I'm really glad with the iPhone, I can block every one of these people. So I don't get them on my cell phone as much. But at home, I just click answer and off as quick as I can. And that usually stops it. Now, occasionally I've missed a call. Like one time Linda's doctor called and I did that. He didn't recognize the number, but he called right back. So I knew to answer that. I knew it must be somebody that actually wanted to talk to us or needed to. I see on the news regularly and people are scammed out of their information. Give me your social security number. What do you need my social security number for? You don't. And so you want to, naivete is okay to a point, but then there's a time where you've got to grow up. You've got to see the world as it is. And it's a horrible, awful place. Peter calls it dark and dismal, is the way he refers to it, I think, in 2 Peter there. A gloomy place. That the light of doctrine is the only thing that saves us. And as we were talking at break, too, when you see all this and you see how bad it actually is out there, some people might think, well, he exaggerates. Oh, no, it's awful. It's horrible. I watch people walk out of a store with their head down over their phone and walk into the street and never look up. Now, that's as stupid as anything you can do. There's times I just want to gun it to increase the IQ of the planet. But I don't. I don't. But that's insane. That's the kind of stupidity that exists out there. And that's at a real fundamental level, like your own life. That you step in front of a car, you're going to get hurt. But we've convinced people that pedestrians all have the right of way. They take precedence over a 2,500-pound vehicle. In a conflict, I know who's going to lose. So that's just the way it goes. But that's the insanity of this world. I remember my parents used to, they beat that into us. Not physically beat, but mentally they were always on us. Don't you ever step in front of a car. You look both ways and you don't take one step until you know it's clear. And as a matter of fact, you're supposed to look left, right, and left again. That was pounded into us. This is the way you stay alive, stupid. So I got it. I'm still alive thanks to my mom and dad. At some level, obviously, God has something to do with it. So, but again, to the prudence, give prudence, understanding to the naive, to the youth, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase in learning. And a man of understanding will acquire good advice. That's what wise counsel is. Good advice that you can take and apply. So again, if one is going to do this, the challenge is to first knowing the doctrine. That's a big step in all of this, is knowing the truth that'll protect you from a bunch of this stuff. Well, 37, two of the greatest hindrances to wise and discerning behavior are the believer's own ego. And his emotions. These are the two things that can knock you off your feet. Now, one of the things, and you have to factor in too here, the bodily connection. Because sometimes people are in a foul mood or make bad decisions because their blood sugar's off. They got a physical issue that needs to be attended to. Maybe they didn't get enough sleep. I'm not saying that excuses bad behavior, but I'm saying there can be physical causes for it. Maybe they didn't eat enough that day and they're hangry. That's the new portmanteau word. So that can happen. And you know, other things, it can be from overindulgence. Obviously, if you drink too much and you get drunk, then you're not going to behave wisely at all. But at any rate, you've got your own ego that you've got to keep in check. And that's a big job for all of us, because all of us have one. Some people are nicer about it. But every one of you has got an ego. I know it. But we, as long as we're not trying to assert ourselves and dominate others with our own ego, that's not Christianity. Christianity is the reverse of that. It's seeking to corral your ego and serve others rather than getting your way. So two of the greatest hindrances are his own ego and his emotions. Failure to keep these in check. And some things make us angry. And there's legitimate anger. We saw that back in Ephesians there. Be angry, but don't sin. So there's things that should upset us. And the fact that they do upset us is a sign of spiritual health. That we don't look at the cosmos and say, well, they're all basically okay. No, they're nut jobs out there. They don't have any sense about life in many cases or how they even go about living it. They're alive, but they're dead while living. That's what's sad. So the failure to keep these in check will result in a skewed view of things and leave the believer off balance. So again, I'm not trying to make excuses for people who are emotional because they haven't eaten or all of that. But that happens. And so you have to be aware of these things. This is what part of the bodily exercise thing. It's profitable for a little while we're alive, to take care of ourselves and keep the body in check. Well, one reference work notes that such insight, which frequently includes ethical discrimination and discernment, stands in stark contrast to things like inexperience. That's the verse. I didn't realize I had this in here, but we're there already. So inexperience is prudence to the naive. That's the inexperienced person. They haven't seen enough of the world to know what it's really like. They have a skewed view of things because they've been sheltered. And while we want to take care of our children, and ideally as a parent, you'd like to spare your children all suffering. But that's not a healthy way to live for them. They have to recognize that decisions have consequences. And sometimes they need to suffer for those bad decisions. Here's the rules, and you make bad decisions and get outside these lines, and there's going to be a price to pay. With me as the authority in the home, and with God. That's the lesser thing. And God will do things more than what, I would do in terms of discipline and such. God breaks bones. God can put a smack down on somebody that first I wouldn't have the heart to do it. You know, if God said, I want you to discipline this guy, go break his arm. What? The verse, he's never told me that. He never talks that way. So don't think that's ever happened or will. But the fact is, naive young people are dumb. This is just the way life is. Here's your takeaway from today. Young people are dumb. And but they can outgrow that. But I was dumb once. I know this is true because I was there. You hit that age where you just begin to think you know it all. For me, it was about probably 11 or 12. And I always knew I was smarter than my parents. But my dad, he had to quit school. I think he got to quit in the ninth grade when his dad died. He had to go to work. So he had, a high school education. That was about it. And my mom had that. And, of course, you know, by the time, you know, when I'm in school in the 60s and early 70s, you know, math was changing dramatically. We were getting into computers and all, you know, that my parents weren't able to keep up with it. But then I got to thinking, well, see, I'm smarter than them. I know way more than they do. I don't need to listen to them. And I'd tell them, you know, I don't need to listen to you. Like I told her, you can't wash out my mouth with soap. You ain't big enough. She was. She was big enough. And I was small enough to get it. So again, we start out dumb. All of us do. This isn't an insult, by the way. That you don't have any... A lack of experience is not an insult. It's not designed to be. But it should be remedied, however. You don't want to live that way all your life. And this is the problem with giving kids everything they want. I mean, this is just part of the problem. They grow up thinking the world owes them a living. And then when they get out there in the world, they're going to find out. Not so. Not so. And so all these household codes, say, that we just studied in Ephesians, are so critical that everybody know their doctrinal part and place in the plan. And fulfill that doctrinal part and place. So again, here, insight or discrimination is in contrast to things like inexperience. It's in contrast to things like lack of discipline. Some people just don't want to discipline themselves. And they certainly aren't going to tolerate anybody else disciplining them. But this gets into some of it, not all of it, but can be failure on the part of the parents. That they never dealt with the child's sin nature. You've got to deal with it early and often. And it doesn't go away, and it doesn't get better. And the older they get, especially when they hit those teenage years, whoo, they're so smart. And, of course, I was there too. So I told them, as soon as I get 18, I'm out of here. I'm going to live in your house. I'm running my own life. I don't need you anymore. I'll show you. Yeah, 6 months later, motorcycle wreck, guess where I was? Back on my parents' couch. So God has ways of humbling us. And thankfully he kept me alive because I was an unbeliever at that time. That's a frightening deal. You look back after you get saved and think, oh my God, I'd have gone to hell that day. But God spared me somehow. I still am really blessed after all of that. I mean, everything from the waist down was pretty much just crushed. And stayed in traction in one position in bed for 40 days without ever moving. But I don't have a whole lot of pain. I'm able to still get around. I have a couple of small issues, but nothing I could really gripe about. But other people are facing much bigger physical tests than I am. So God obviously has a way of blessing us too, if we're positive and want to do things right. He can take care of us. Well, whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. But he who hates reproof is stupid. I like that one. If you don't like, everybody's going to be told they're wrong sometimes. It's just learning how to deal with it with your ego. And don't assume, of course, I know how the defense mechanisms work. Somebody comes to you and says, you're wrong. No, I'm not. You're wrong. You're a towel. So you have to be willing to listen. And sometimes recognize, okay, I could be wrong. I could be what? I don't like saying that, but it's true. We got to know that. And we may get insight from somebody. So being told you're wrong is a part of life. Reproof is a way of life, as he says in another place. And it's also in contrast to foolishness. 15:7. The lips of the wise spread knowledge. But the heart of fools are not so. You're not going to get anything of real value out of a fool. That's the problem. So it is very good to be discerning and know when you're dealing with a fool. If you know you're dealing with a person that won't listen, you're dealing with a fool. Because all the Proverbs repeatedly talks about this ability to take reproof, to listen, to pay attention. And then what happens when you don't? Like back in chapter 1, what happens when you don't pay attention? Well, let's see, verse 22. Wisdom is attempting to get through to people. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers, how long will you delight yourself in scoffing? How long will fools hate knowledge? Turn at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. But because I called and you refused. See, the fool isn't a fool only because he lacks intelligence or maybe comes from a bad background. The fool is a fool because he hasn't listened. That's the one thing that could save him from this, is actually paying attention and listening. But I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention. You neglected all my counsel. That's my advice. And you did not want my reproof. In other words, you didn't want me telling you you were wrong. And so wisdom personified now says, I will laugh at your calamity. There comes a time when wisdom says, that's right, you had your chance, too bad, you didn't take it. And I will mock when your dread comes. And people are going to experience fear in this world. That's one thing that is a given. They seek to, it seems like to me, the media are in much ways nowadays nothing more than fear mongers. That's a large part of what they do. Try to keep you scared. I remember back when they had the new Homeland Security and all that. Live your life as if everything is normal, but be on high alert at all times. If you see something, say something. You've got to, you know, but just be normal and relaxed. Well, psychologically, you can't live that way. That is a conflict just waiting to erupt. I will mock when your dread comes. And when your dread comes like a storm and your calamity comes like a tornado. When distress and anguish come on you, they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not. Hey, where's the grace in this? This sounds like judgment to me and not grace. And this is the dangerous game people are playing with God and His plan. Is that they think grace is going to last forever. They think there's always, I can always fix it later. We'll see. Apparently you can't always fix it later if you don't listen now. So again, one reference work here notes that again, this discrimination and insight and all of that are, these are the things they fix: inexperience, a lack of discipline, and foolishness. And several commentators have pointed out that eisthesis, discernment, and the verb diaphero, excellent things, that follows in verse 10, are terms that are found frequently in the Greek philosophers. And 40, it would be wrong to think that Paul was dependent upon cosmic philosophers for his views. However, it demonstrates that Paul elevated concepts and ideas in the world around him and defined or redefined them in Christian terms. And it's inevitable, no matter when you live in history, it's inevitable that you're going to come into conflict with the world system if you're a positive believer. And so again, one of the things that will stand out, I think, the longer we get into this book, is this anti-imperial, but I don't like to call it rhetoric, because Paul is not simply attacking the Roman system. But the Roman system's in conflict with Christianity. So it has to be pointed out. And Caesar is not Lord. Jesus is Lord. Caesar, good news, isn't the birth of Caesar's child. It was the birth of Messiah. And so all the language that they used is used in Christianity and refined and elevated to a new level. The truth. And this is going to bring you into conflict with the cosmos. Because people today, they would not like our teaching on materialism. See the doctrine of materialism. Quit pursuing money. Most people don't want to hear that. People believe they're free to come and go as they... The church doesn't even factor into their decisions half the time. Not their own spiritual benefit and well-being doesn't even factor in. They're just going to do it. So, again, Paul elevates all this, and there's going to be a certain amount of conflict with the cosmos. It's unavoidable. But he uses these terms to communicate a Christian pattern of thinking. Morality that is not based on human efforts like Hellenism or Stoicism, etc. Not based on law, Judaism. But on the greatest virtue of Christian love. That this is to be the basis for what we do. 1 Corinthians 13. 13. And this chapter deals at length with the value of love in terms of how it acts. How it's defined. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not jealous. Love does not brag. Love is not arrogant. Love doesn't act unbecomingly. Love does not seek its own. Bummer. Because a lot of times that's where the conflict comes. I'm busy seeking my own. I'm busy wanting it my way. And somebody doesn't do it my way. Well, we've got conflict then. Well, no, we're to learn to lay that aside and quit just wanting our own way. But to look to what's best for everyone. So it does not seek its own. Love is not provoked. Love does not take into account a wrong suffered. What? I mean, I have to forgive and forget and move on? Yep, that's what love's all about. It doesn't rejoice in unrighteousness. It rejoices with the truth. And love is superior to everything. Because there are three really critical Christian virtues. And that's where we are at the end of the chapter. But now, faith, hope, and love. And he's talking about now as opposed to the... And this passage, again, has been badly mangled by people. This business of the perfect coming being the Bible, that's nonsense. I heard that explanation back when I was a fundy, and it didn't set right then. And then when I could actually exegete and look at it in the Greek and all, and some of this isn't even that hard. Because Paul's talking about, in verse 9, our incomplete knowledge and understanding. But that incomplete knowledge and understanding will give way to a full knowledge and understanding in phase 3. We won't have all these questions. We won't be seeing through a glass, or as he says here, now we see in a mirror dimly. But then, and he's contrasting the then and the now. The perfect coming refers to the kingdom of God, when it finally takes possession of this world and begins to rule. That's what we're talking about. Then the partial's done away. Well, now we have imperfect revelation, imperfect knowledge, all that. One day we'll have it all. We'll know everything that we need to know. So he says, now I know in part. Verse 12. But then I will know fully, just as I have also been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love. These three remain. But the greatest of these is love. Why? Because love is eternal. You won't need faith or hope in phase 3. We need faith and hope now. But we won't need faith and hope in phase 3. Love is the one that will transcend all of these. So again, this is the virtue where we want to build, as it were, Christian lives and Christian churches. Is in a sound and thorough understanding of love and a discerning and a knowledgeable love. That's not just taken in by everything or anything, in fact. All right, well, let's get started here today. I don't know how far we'll get in this. Maybe we can get the vocabulary done. But to deal with this matter of discernment. And here's the two-edged sword with discernment. We are to be, and it's clear from Ephesians, and we'll see it even again in Philippians here, we are to be open and tolerant and seeking to work together with other believers in love. What happens when they won't? Well, we can't just pretend it's not happening. We can't just look the other way. We have to deal with the situation not as we would like it to be, but as it actually is. And if a person's not following their marching orders, what does Paul say to do? Separate from them. Don't have fellowship with that person. Don't encourage them. And the loss of fellowship is supposed to bring people to their senses. Well, it doesn't anymore to speak of that I've seen. They just conclude that, well, the church has the problem. Everybody there must be wrong. I'm right. Well, that's one way to approach life, that everybody's wrong and you're right. But unfortunately, that's not always true. Now, that could be true on an isolated occasion. I'll grant that. The tenor of public opinion may be wrong. And you may be right. It can happen. But the idea here is if when people aren't following their orders, then we have to be discerning about it. And this gets into this matter of not only do we recognize, I mean, I think the Bible's pretty plain. You're supposed to keep the cosmos at arm's length. That you're not to be having relationships with them, personal friendships, going on vacation with them, getting into business with them and all of that. Certainly dating or marrying in the cosmos. This is obviously forbidden. The scriptures are very plain on this. But then we get into believers. So much of the text that we study says the believers are to be unified and all and one. And to all have the same mindset. And all function in the same way in some sense. I mean, obviously we're individuals and we have different spiritual gifts and different functions. But if all of us are doing our part, well, then that works together for the good of the body. And then when their people aren't, or they're creating conflict and dissension and division within the body, those people are going to have to be dealt with, unfortunately. And hopefully they would come to their senses. But once people get that arrogant, and they're pretty sure they're way smarter than the pastor and everybody else, for that matter, there's not a whole lot of hope for them at that point. They're pretty well doomed. And God can get through to them, obviously. God can throw a grenade right into their life and get their attention, maybe. But my experience has been when people go negative, it doesn't seem to me that God does that. I'm not saying it doesn't, because I don't know every person in their experience that's gone negative. But I've seen enough of them that look like they just walk away and get away with it. So then there's no fear of God anymore. You don't have to fear God because he's not going to do anything. Well, we'll see how that plays out at the Bema Seat, though. That's going to be a big issue there. All right, well, point one here, vocabulary, the Hebrew vocabulary. First word, and this is the one that's used far and away the most, is bein, B-I-Y-N. The verb means to discern. It has the idea of to be separate or distinct. It really has the idea of two things. To be distinct, to consider, to perceive, or to even understand. 1 Kings 3:9 is one of the places it's used. And this is when Solomon gets the throne. And he's got his own problems. Don't assume Solomon's got it all together. Verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And in Gibeon, where he goes to do this, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night in verse 5. And God said, "Ask what you wish me to give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. You have reserved for him this great loving kindness that you have given him a son to set on his throne, as it is this day. But now, Lord, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. Yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to come out, go out or come in." He's not saying he couldn't use a door. That's not what he means here. He didn't know how to conduct himself as a king. How should a king conduct himself? And there's the standards by which. The way he presents it. The way he even appears in public. In terms of dress and behavior and demeanor and all of that. And when he says, "I don't know how to go out to deal with the things a king has to deal with." One of the things they had to do was go out to war. Now, in Solomon's case, that didn't happen. David had made peace. He defeated everybody around him, and Solomon had peace for the years of his reign. He wasn't having to fight wars. And he said, "I don't know how to go out or come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who are too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people." To judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And this is a part of true humility, is recognizing I'm really not up for everything. I don't have all the answers. Solomon recognized I don't have the experience. That was a thing he lacked here. And so I think our bane, actually, there's a conjunction there that means between, and it's related to this word being. And so it has the idea of between two things. How do you know which choice to make? The second one, shama, verb, literally means to hear. This is the verb for hearing. And in some contexts, it has the nuance of hearing properly, making a proper assessment of the facts based on listening. 2 Samuel 14:17. Then your maidservant said, "Please let the word of my lord the king be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is my Lord the King to discern good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. And the word discern there is actually the word to hear. So it has the idea of he could hear the truth and then he could come to the proper conclusion that he listened. So this word doesn't technically mean discernment, but it gets there in some cases. Nakare, a verb 49 times. This means to treat something as strange or different. To recognize something by carefully examining or inspecting it. Genesis 31, 32. The one with whom you find your God. Now, this is when Rachel, who's a reversionist, she's a believer, but she's a pretty messed up believer. In fact, God's going to kill her on this trip home. She's not going to make it back. She didn't ever live there anyway, but Jacob did. He'd gotten out of the land. But Laban comes after him. Because the teraphim, these are their little household god. They were sort of the gods of the good life, like Bud, you know, and Mick. These are the good life gods. They weren't really alcohol. I'm kidding there. But they were symbols of the good life that people wanted in their house. And so they thought these little trinkets, these little gods would help them, would provide that for them. So the one with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, you point out what is yours among my belongings. Now Jacob's upset because Laban's come after him and Jacob's only done right by Laban. He was a little shady on a couple of things, but he hasn't stolen from Laban. He's been, in that regard, pretty stellar. But take it, and you take it for yourself if you find it. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen him. Whoops. Because if he would have inspected her stuff, he would have found him. And what would he have done? Well, we don't know, and it doesn't really matter because it didn't happen. But Rachel had him. And so here the idea, point out what is yours in my belongings. Here I have to go look and see where this word is. Not care to you. Well, I'll have to look for it. I should have marked this in my text so I would have remembered it here. But at any rate. But he inspects it, obviously. He examines the goods. And, of course, he doesn't find them because Laban went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and all of that. And now Rachel had taken, in verse 34, if you look ahead, had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tent but did not find them. And so she lies to her dad. She said, "Let my Lord not be angry that I cannot arise before you, for the manner of women is upon me." So you can figure out there what's happening. She used her period as an excuse. Well, she wasn't really having it, but she claimed to be. So that's how she lied to him and got away with it. Yadab, the verb literally means to know, to become acquainted with, to distinguish so as to understand. You have to have some knowledge to make a distinction. Proverbs 14:7. And some of these more common terms have derived a little bit of a technical sense to them in these contexts. So leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern the words of knowledge. Literally, you won't know them. Because all you're going to hear out of a fool is babble. You're not going to hear a lot of knowledge. And so you won't know knowledge if you do this. Sakal, 61 times, the verb means to consider or reflect on something. To comprehend something by gaining insight into it. Daniel 9:25. So you are to know and determine, and discern rather, I'm sorry, know and discern. And he uses yada, the verb there to know, and then follows it with this one. You will know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Literally seven sevens and 62 sevens. The word weeks is just a translation of the Hebrew sevens. And it will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. And so the command here, but once Daniel, of course this happens after Daniel he's going to die before he sees all this, of course. But this was, he had questions about how God was going to work out all of this plan. And Daniel wanted to know, have information about it. Particularly, he was fascinated in some ways by Antichrist. But Daniel wanted some information, and he says in verse 23, this is why he gets it. He said, at the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued. And I have come to tell you because you are highly esteemed. So give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. And basically, this particular teaching here would have allowed any discerning Jew to pinpoint when Messiah should have been on the planet. That Messiah was coming, and this was their time schedule for it. That doesn't mean they got it, they didn't. But there was a lot of messianic expectation around the first advent. And why? Because some people did understand that the time was right. Now, they believed in a lot of fake messiahs and other things. There were a lot of frauds and pretenders. But the fact is, when you trace this out, and I've seen some who've said, well, you can trace this out, and this is right down to the very day. I don't think that's the case, but my work didn't lead me to that conclusion. But that certainly, this puts you into a time after the 62 weeks when Messiah is cut off. And that has to refer to nothing more than his death and burial. There that he's done, as it appears from the human perspective, he's done. And so they should have been able to identify. But again, they didn't study their Bibles. They turned it into a work system. They were very misguided. Their religious leaders lacked understanding. That's real evident when they went and interviewed John the Baptist. They had no clue what these passages meant. So, but Daniel was able to get all this because he wanted to know. See, part of discernment is you got to want to know. If you don't want to know, God, there's no reason to be discerning if you don't want to know the truth. The truth just allows you to distinguish. So the cognate here, noun, sakel, 16 times. In a good sense, it means insight or prudence. In a bad sense, it means shrewdness or cunning, depending upon context. So Proverbs 12:8 is used in a good context. A man will be praised according to his insight. And one of the things, you know, if you look up to people, that you ought to look up to people that have discernment and wisdom and insight and all of that. And appreciate that. But one of perverse mind will be despised. And of course our verb, literally there, insight is that one. And then shrewdness or cunning, it's used in Daniel in a bad way. Because people can get discernment and insight so they can, you know, use it properly or so they can put something over on somebody. And that's the shrewdness and the cunning part of it. They're trying to put something over. Here, Daniel 8:25, and through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. This is a reference to Antichrist. And he will magnify himself in his heart. And he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the Prince of Princes. But he will be broken without human agency. And we know that at the end, Jesus Christ takes the Antichrist himself and casts him into the lake of fire. Nobody. He doesn't need any help, doesn't need any army, doesn't need any weapons. He's going to do it all by himself. Apart from human agency, God's going to break this guy. And then sekel, noun, an alternate form of the above noun with the same meaning. Ta'am, A noun 13 times, literally the sense of taste. And what is tasting good for? Let you know what stuff is. The faculty of making a distinction between things by means of good judgment. Exodus 16:31. The house of Israel named it manna. This, of course, became its permanent name. It's funny because Imanhu in the Hebrew just means what is it? They've been briefed about it. They've been warned it was coming. But then when God dumped this stuff on them overnight, they didn't know what it was. And so that's what they called it for the rest of the time was manna. What is it? And it was like coriander seed, white. And its taste was like wafers with honey. Well, that sounds sweet. The taste of it is what you're getting there. So, in a sense, that's a form of discernment. Your taste buds discern what's going on, whether it's salty or sweet or savory or whatever, sour. They discern for you. Then Proverbs 11:22. I love this one. As a ring of gold in a swine's snout. Put some lipstick on that pig. Still a pig. Doesn't change it. So is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion. And the world's filled with these. But when they don't know that charm is fleeting, beauty is fading, and that they're not going to always be the hot thing they are now. A beautiful woman who lacks discretion, can't handle her tongue, can't make good decisions, and there'll be a path of destruction in her wake as well. That's a given, and it'll be dumb men most often. That's who she'll take advantage of. The Greek vocabulary here, point one here, diakrino, 19, literally to judge through. To differentiate things by separating one item from another. To make a conclusion as to the differences or distinctions between two or more items. 1 Corinthians 14. And this is one of the things you see that this word, people can use judgment and make it seem like it's always a bad thing. You're judging me. Well, if they're not judging your mental attitude, they're not judging you. They may be simply just evaluating. Now, if they're addressing, saying what you think, obviously they can't know that, other than to the extent that you would make it plain. 1 Corinthians 14:29, let two or three prophets speak. Now, this is, again, when you had this office that was still extant. There were apostles, prophets, evangelists, and pastor teachers all in the first century church. But the prophets weren't considered infallible. This is another whole thing. This one of the things I've heard against the spiritual gift of prophecy. Well, you have to be 100% right all the time. No, you don't. Good Lord. Here, this verse shows you don't have to be. And they actually had prophets, not just somebody with the gift of prophecy, who could fail under that gift just like anybody could fail under any other gift. And that was one of the reasons I had really faced some stiff resistance at first to this idea that these spiritual gifts in Romans 12 were the permanent ones. Because that was the argument. Well, you have to always be right. No, you don't. Are you saying that every teacher has never taught one thing wrong? Every person with the gift of giving never gave to a wrong cause once, even? Every person with the gift of exhortation has never gone too far and discouraged the person they were trying to help? Of course people fail under their spiritual gifts. But even when they had actual prophets, legitimate men in this office, they weren't viewed as infallible in the New Testament. Their words were tested and discerned. So let two or three prophets speak. And again, the first church services In the first century, we would have thought probably our were certainly more chaotic than what ours are. Because you had all these temporary gifts functioning, you had the permanent gifts right beside them, you had these people with different offices that weren't necessarily local, because the first three offices, apostle, a prophet, and evangelist, doesn't demand a single location. In fact, apostle and evangelist would suggest multiple locations. And so does prophet in that regard. So let two or three prophets speak and let the others pass judgment. Now, again, some have argued here, well, these are other prophets passing judgment. Yes, that's fine, because he uses alos and not heteros. He's not saying let the congregation at large pass judgment, but let other people who have this same office make these distinctions. And so the fact that they have to evaluate it should tell you that it's not viewed as infallible. It's not viewed as perfect in that regard. And also James chapter 2. Verse 4, here he's bemoaning the fact that they're prejudiced towards rich people and give them better treatment. James doesn't find this fun at all. He's very opposed to this. And he points out, have you not made distinctions among yourselves? That's our diakrino. And here used in a bad sense. They judge these things wrongly and have become judges with evil motives. Because, again, if you're going to treat the rich one way and the poor another, you failed. Because there's no reason for that. Well, they're getting louder and louder, so I'm going to stop there before I... we only got a couple of minutes left, so we'll just stop there and get this wrapped up on Wednesday, the vocabulary part anyway. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.